Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 13th day of December 2011. And today I'm joined on the line by Donna LaFramboise, an author and also the former vice president of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. But she is also the author of a climate skepticism blog at nofrackingconsensus.com and the author of a brand new IPCC expose called The Delinquent Teenager Who Was Mistaken for the World's Top Climate Expert. Donna, it's great to have you on the program today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, as I say, it's great to have you here, especially to talk about this book, which has been garnering quite a bit of positive press and quite a lot of very interesting reviews. It bills itself, of course, as an IPCC expose, and I suppose in order to get everyone on the same page, perhaps it would be beneficial to start by dissecting the IPCC itself, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, obviously, and maybe we could start by talking about what this organization is and how it was first formed and why an expose of it is important.
Well, as you say, it's got a very long name, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and which is why most of us just shorten it to IPCC. It was established 22 years ago, back in 1988, by the United Nations. And the purpose, we were told, of this panel was to survey the scientific literature out there about climate change, not to conduct any new research, but simply to look at the research that was out there to decide what it all meant and to write a report. And the report is informally called the Climate Bible. It is the one document that governments all over the world point to and say, we have to take these steps to combat climate change because the Climate Bible tells us that it's a serious problem and it's going to get worse if we don't. So really, anyone who belongs to the United Nations belongs to the IPCC. So it's really kind of a very large United Nations committee. And there are difficulties with those kinds of committees because it's very difficult for them to be accountable to anyone in particular because there are always, at the United Nations level of politics, there are always blocks of voting blocks, and there are all kinds of other concerns that are going on that have nothing to do with the matter at hand. So when you have a large body like that controlled by everyone in the world, it's actually very difficult to have a committee that is very accountable. And so we have been told that this committee, this panel, consists of the world's top scientists, that they're recruited from around the world, and that they take a very serious look at the literature and they write a report. And so when I started doing research about climate, I formed this view in my mind of a very respectable grown-up in a three-piece suit. It was writing rigorous reports. It was meticulous. The reports were authoritative. They were trustworthy. We could depend on what the Climate Bible said. That was the image that formed in my mind. And unfortunately, as I did more research about the IPCC, a very different image formed in my mind. And that image was of a spoiled child, a child who has been admired and praised and flattered by everyone, especially the world's media, for 22 years. Has never had anyone take a close critical look at it, has never really been subjected to scrutiny, in fact has been given rules to follow, has broken those rules outrageously, has suffered no consequences as a result. So I started to see the IPCC as a delinquent teenager who's kind of grown up and become all of our problem. Because they will, you know, this panel writes this report that is incredibly important. Trillions of dollars are being spent based on what this report says. And yet the panel that is writing it turns out to be a very troubled, very problematic organization,
to say the least. Well, in the press material for your book, it indicates that this book began as a book about reasons to remain calm, cool, and collected in the face of hype and hysteria, but morphed into a rather different project. Can you tell us a little bit about what the initial impetus for this book was and how it came to morph?
Well, I'm I spent more than a decade as a journalist in Canada mostly during the 1990s. I did a great deal of investigative work, but I'd never done anything about the environment. I'd never paid attention to that. So, and then I decided, after being laid off by the National Post in 2001 with 130 other people when it was sold, that it was time to move on and do something else. So I left writing. I left journalism for pretty much 8 years or so. And I'm just an ordinary citizen reading the newspapers, reading the news magazines. And I started to get very annoyed at how climate change was being covered in the media, because it seemed to me there was a lot of hype, there was a lot of very emotionally laden language, but not very much serious analysis. In fact, the analysis struck me as very shallow. And so I started to do a little bit of research on my own, and I started to read a few books. And it became very clear to me very quickly that the climate change debate is far more complicated than most of us have been told by our news sources, that in fact there are very reputable, very experienced, very credentialed scientists out there who don't think climate change is very alarming. Now, I'm not one of those people who say climate change doesn't happen. Of course it happens. Everything changes all the time. You know, planet Earth has been around for 4.5 billion years, and it's been constantly changing. So, of course, climate changes. But the question is, are we as human beings doing something unusual to the climate, and can we be sure that we are the cause, and can we be sure that what's happening is in fact dangerous? Those are the real questions. And it seemed to me that there were lots of scientists out there who disagreed with this alarming notion that, you know, we're at a tipping point and we have to change our whole lives radically or else there's going to be a climate catastrophe. And I got very annoyed that I hadn't heard about those people. So I thought I would write a book that was 10 reasons to be calm, cool, and collected about global warming. And just to point out, there is this diversity of opinion out there. And we should perhaps be a little more informed before we get so alarmed about an issue that's this important.
Well, as you say, people do have the impression that the IPCC is this august body and it has these meticulous, upstanding professionals behind it. But the reality is something much different, as you go on to detail in your book. Can you tell us a little bit about your findings and what really surprised you about who's really behind the IPCC?
Well, the amazing thing is that, it's very common for a journalist to, an organization claims that it does X and Y and that it consists of these sorts of members. And it's very normal, at least for when I was a journalist, to go and double check if all of those things were true. But with the IPCC, it's been around for 22 years and appears to no other journalist bothered to go and do some rudimentary fact checking. So I was quite astonished when I started looking at who is helping to write the climate Bible for the IPCC. I found that these weren't the world's top experts and the best scientists. In fact, I found that a number of the people who have been lead authors for the IPCC were graduate students. Students. There is a big difference between someone who is a student and someone who is a world-class expert. But these were students who, in some cases, were 10 or 16 years away from completing their PhD. And yet, they were lead authors for the IPCC. In fact, I found one young man who hadn't even finished his master's degree. And, you know, I'm sure he's a very nice person, and I'm sure he's very bright. Right. But if you haven't even finished your master's degree, you are not one of the world's top experts. So that was one category of people that I discovered. Another category I discovered who were very influential, who were lead authors, who were leading chapters, were employees of activist organizations. And you know what? There is a role in our society for activist organizations, but someone who is taking a paycheck from Greenpeace or the World Wildlife Fund or a long list of other organizations like that is not one of the world's top scientists. They are employed by a lobby group. They have an agenda. So I found a number of people who have in the past been IPCC authors and who are now not only being IPCC authors for the upcoming version of the report, but they are in fact leading chapters of the IPCC. They are in leadership roles. So that's another group. So we have students, we have professional activists. We also, as it turns out, have a lot of people who are lead authors for the IPCC who are named lead authors, not because they're the world's top experts, but because this is a UN body and the UN wants it. Wants us to believe that this is an international effort, that writing the climate Bible was done by people all over the world. So it turns out, and IPCC insiders themselves have told us this in a questionnaire, an anonymous questionnaire that they filled out last year when there was a bit of an investigation into the IPCC. These people have told us that many or half or all of the people who are being appointed to write IPCC reports are being appointed for political reasons. So depending on who you believe when you read the answers to these questionnaires, you know, some or half or all of the people have been political issues. So do they represent the right country? Are they of the right gender? You know, do we have enough people from South America participating in this chapter? So it turns out a lot of the people writing this report, no one believes they are the world's top experts. Everyone knows. In fact, the insiders use words like they're not qualified, they are not competent, they are out of their intellectual depth. That's who's been writing IPCC reports. Well, that is pretty bloody shocking.
Well, perhaps you can give us a better idea of what it is the IPCC lead authors actually do, because I can imagine that some people who might want to defend the panel might say that, well, the authors are just really taking the summary of the scientific data itself and putting it into a narrative form. So it's not really, their input is not particularly important, but perhaps you can give us a better perspective on what their contribution to the report really is.
Okay. Well, what the authors do is everything. It is essential. As I say, their job is supposed to be to survey all the available literature to decide which of the different theories out there is most compelling, and then to write a report saying, this in our judgment, this is what's happening, this is what we think is going to happen in the future, this is what we think we as humans should do in response, okay? What the authors do for the IPCC, particularly the lead authors, is crucial. It is, we are depending on their judgment. They are making an assessment of the existing literature. So in fact, if you had grad students who were simply, you know, helping to assemble some documents, that would be fine. But these people are using their expert judgment to decide what's going on out there, what the scientific literature tells us. So it is crucial that they actually be very experienced people, that they be very sober people. And that's what we've been told they are. We've been told they're the world's top experts. And then we find out that many of them are actually something very different. And I'm sure there have been some of the world's top experts have been involved. I'm sure. I'm not saying every last person has been unqualified. What I'm saying is that there is an awful lot of people who don't come close to being the world's top experts. And yet we as people who depend on the climate Bible are really, you know, making decisions based on their expert judgment.
Well, as you've indicated, the type of discrepancy that exists between the public's understanding of the IPCC and what it really is and how it really functions could only exist in a type of media vacuum about scrutiny into the organization itself. Why do you think that media vacuum exists? Why has there been no really detailed exposé of the IPCC before your book?
Well, that is a very good question. And unfortunately, the answers do not reflect what I think the answers are, do not reflect well on the media. And I think the answer is that the media has been very lazy, and the media has given a pass to the IPCC, as it gives a pass to most things environmental, because the media consider, many journalists consider themselves environmentalists. They think it's a good cause. They get very confused, in my view, and start to think that it's their job to promote a good cause rather than to give the public information so the public can make up its own mind about these matters. And if you go back to 1970, the very first Earth Day, you know, there's a wonderful paper that's a scholarly paper that was written about this. And the woman who wrote it said, we have this idea that environmentalists were, they had to toil against incredible odds before or anyone would pay any attention to them. But if you go back to 1970, very large magazines, and they were very influential at the time because there were far fewer magazines, like Life magazine, was promoting Earth Day months before it even happened. The fact of the matter is that the media has been on side, helping to promote the environmental message for 40 years. Okay, the media has never really been very critical of the environmental movement. In fact, quite the opposite. So we have an entire generation, perhaps two, of journalists who don't think it's their job to look critically at an environmental organization. If the way they would look critically at, say, the police, or a corporation, you know, they think, well, it's for the environment, it's doing a good job, it's for a good cause, we should just applaud it. And the problem with that is that the media is supposed to be one of the checks and balances that helps to keep big organizations honest. And when you have a big international organization like the IPCC and no one is helping to keep it honest, then really bad things happen. And the astonishing thing about this story is that I have never seen a story like this as a journalist. Every time I have turned over a rock with respect to the IPCC, every time I've thought, I wonder if I should check that out, I find a scandal under that rock. It's like shooting a fish in a barrel. Practically every time I try to verify one of the IPCC's claims, I find out it's bogus. You can really tell that the media has not been holding these people to account because they've gotten very sloppy.
Well, of all the scandals that you managed to expose by turning over those rocks, was there any that particularly surprised you, or one that stands out to you as a particularly egregious example of what you're talking about?
Oh, dear. Well, there are so many. Let me think. The fact that these people are not, many of them are not the world's top experts was a real problem. It was a real shock to me. I just thought, oh my goodness, this can't be true. This can't be true. But it is. The fact that, well, actually, perhaps the biggest one for me was the chairman of the IPCC is a gentleman named Rajendra Pachauri. And Rajendra Pachauri has been the chairman since 2002, so almost a decade now. And he has been going around the world saying that we should take all of these massive steps to respond to climate change because his organization says so. And he tells us that we should believe his organization's report, we should believe the Climate Bible. And one of the reasons he said we should believe it and trust in it is because he said that all of the information that the lead authors examine when they write this report comes from the peer-reviewed scientific literature, that all of the information was published in scientific journals that have their own checks and balances called peer review. Now, whether or not peer review ensures truth is a separate question, and the short answer is no, it does not. But This was what Dr. Pachauri, as chairman of the IPCC, said. He said, "We don't settle for anything less than material that has been peer-reviewed. If it hasn't been peer-reviewed," he said, "it's beneath the IPCC's notice, and we should just toss it into the dustbin." Those are his words. "We'll toss it into the dustbin. It's not, it doesn't qualify to be considered by the IPCC." Now, this man has been going around saying these sorts of things for years. I have documented all sorts of cases. He said it to newspapers. He has said it in magazine interviews. He has said it when he has written articles that appeared in newspapers. You can find him saying it on YouTube videos. He has been saying this message. Everything that the IPCC considers was published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. Well, it turns out that's complete and utter nonsense. I started looking at the references in the back of a particular chapter of the IPCC report, the last one. It came out in 2007, and there are 44 chapters. I started looking at the references listed at the end of that chapter because an economist on a blog had complained that in a particular part of the IPCC report, the IPCC had ignored peer-reviewed material, what the findings of peer-reviewed material, and it in fact cited non-peer-reviewed material instead to make a completely opposite point because the opposite point said something alarming. And the peer-reviewed literature did not. So this economist on a blog post said, you know, was complaining about this. And I thought, well, but how could that possibly be? How could the IPCC be citing non-peer-reviewed literature, is often called gray literature, if it's only allowed to cite peer-reviewed stuff? So I went and I looked at the references to that particular chapter, and I found out that large numbers of them were not published in peer-reviewed journals. And I thought, okay, this is not right. And then I looked at another chapter, and I found the same thing. And I thought, what is going on here? So because there are 44 chapters, and because some of those reference lists contain 800 or more references, this was a very big task to figure out what percentage of them were actually from peer-reviewed scientific journals. So about a year and a half ago on my blog, I recruited people, readers, to help me count the references. And more than 40 people from 12 different countries, amazingly, signed up to help me. And in 5 weeks, we counted all of these references. And there are more than 18,500 references total in the last Climate Bible. And we counted each chapter three times. So three people who did not know each other, who did not know what chapters they were working on, totally independently counted the chapters and said, okay, this is how many references were published in peer-reviewed journals, and this is how many were not. And then when we got in the three totals, we took the one that was most favorable to the IPCC. We took the highest count because this was not about nitpicking. And we said, okay, what is the total result? And what we found is that one in three, 30% of the sources cited by the IPCC's last Climate Bible were to non-peer-reviewed literature, even though the chairman has been going around saying that it's 100% peer-reviewed literature. Now, that's just quite astonishing. And the amazing thing is that all of this is freely available on the internet. Anyone can go to the IPCC's website, click on a chapter, go to the references at the back, and check this out for themselves. It means that hundreds of people who were involved in writing the IPCC reports knew the chairman was going around the world saying something that was totally wrong. And no one, apparently, took him aside and said, "Sir, you can't say that. It's not true." What does that tell us about the culture of the IPCC? That this was going on, that the chairman was misleading the entire world, and no one stood up and raised their hand and said, falsehoods are being told here. The public is being misled. This is not right.
Well, then finally, Donna, as someone who has spent some time studying the IPCC and the way it functions, or perhaps more accurately, malfunctions, from your perspective, to what extent do you think it's even useful to have a body like the IPCC that tries to condense this vastly complex subject down into one single document that professes to have a consensus view of this extremely, extremely difficult subject that, of course, has so many variables and uncertainties? Or do you think the IPCC is something that could be reformed, or is it something that its very raison d'etre is somehow flawed?
Okay, well, there are a number of questions there, and I'm going to try to answer each of them. Can it be reformed? Personally, I don't think so. It is in my book. I am very critical of Chairman Pachauri. He's a terribly easy target. He says things all the time about his organization that turn out not to be true. So he's a very easy target. But the fact of the matter is that these problems go back long before we're there in the organization, long before Pachauri. They are part of the culture of the IPCC. It is very, very difficult to change an organization's culture. Not impossible, but very difficult. And because no one really runs the IPCC, it's just everyone who belongs to the UN kind of runs it. I don't see that it's realistically possible to reform it. I personally think it should be shut down, and the way to shut it down is for countries to stop funding it. You know, and there are a handful of countries in the world that funded it to a large extent, and those include Canada, the U.S., Japan, Germany, the U.K., probably Switzerland. There are a number of countries that if a couple of them pulled out of the funding, I think the IPCC would wither on the vine pretty quickly. So can it be reformed? I highly doubt it. But to go back to an earlier part of your question, you know, is it reasonable, is it sensible to be conducting this kind of exercise? Here's part of the problem. It took me about 2 years before I finally clued in to the fact that the IPCC's purpose is actually somewhat different from what the public is told. The public is told that the reason we need to do this is because the world needs to know what's happening with climate change. We need this report that boils it all down so that decision makers, governments, can make sound decisions about climate change. That's what we're told the reason the IPCC exists. That's the reason. But in fact, the real reason is somewhat different. And that is that the IPCC's documents are needed so that there can be climate change negotiations at an international level. And I'm not making this up. I am not inferring. Chairman Pachauri himself has said that the main customer of the IPCC is not individual governments trying to make good decisions. The main customer is the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. That convention is an international treaty, okay? It's Kyoto. The Kyoto Protocol is part of that treaty. The real purpose for writing these IPCC reports is before you can have an international negotiation about climate, you have to have an agreement as to what is going on with the climate. You all have to be on the same page so that you can begin negotiations. So in fact, the real role of the Climate Bible is to get all the governments on the same page, to sign on to a common understanding of what's going on in, with respect to climate change, which means that really the Climate Bible is not a scientific document at all, written by the world's top scientists. It is a political document. And there's nothing wrong with being a political document, except that we've been told it's a scientific one. Okay, this is a political document. Once we can all agree what's happening with climate change, then we can go to the next stage and negotiate, an emissions treaty or whatever people think is appropriate. So I think we, I was researching this for 2 years before it finally became clear to me, because there's all this misdirection. Every newspaper article you read tells you that the IPCC is a collection of the world's top experts who write this report that governments all depend on. Well, that may be true, but that's a secondary purpose. The real purpose is to facilitate a global climate treaty. And back in 1988, this was years and years before we had all this research into climate science, the UN decided that a global emissions treaty would be a good idea. There was no science to back it up in 1988. Whatever science there was very superficial and very preliminary, because even now, 22 years later, it's still very uncertain, the science. But really, the purpose of the writing the Climate Bible seems to be to have found a scientific justification for an emissions treaty. And, you know, whether emissions treaties are the best way to address what we think is going on is a very separate question. And my concern as a member of the public is that if climate change is being caused by humans, if it's dangerous, then we deserve to have a public debate about a range of options. Maybe we just decide that, the future is going to take care of itself. And by 50 years from now, when climate change becomes a real issue, then we will have, we will be smarter, our knowledge base will have increased, we will have better technology, and we'll be able to deal with it. Maybe we'll just, and a variation of that is to say, our children are going to be competent human beings who are going to be able to take care of themselves. This notion that we have to solve their problems before these problems even present themselves is a very strange notion, I think. But anyway, maybe we will say we want to go for geoengineering. Maybe we will say we want to do any number of things. Get a second opinion, get a third opinion. But the entire UN has decided that there should be one response to climate change, and that is emissions cuts. And that the emissions cuts cannot happen with a small group of countries. It has to happen with every country signing on to one agreement. And, that's the state we're in right now. And we've just had this big conference in Durban, South Africa, where all of the UN people have gotten together and they tried to negotiate something. I personally think it's not going to happen. Trying to get every country in the world to agree is I think pretty foolish and a really it's a big waste of time. But at any rate, I think I've lost my train of thought, and perhaps you can get me back on track.
I think you did a good job of answering the questions there in that question. Well, then finally, I suppose, what do you think about the Canada's recent announcement that it's withdrawing from the Kyoto Protocol? Do you think that is the first tentative step towards the delegitimization of the IPCC, or at least the turning of the political tide?
I think Canada has been very honest by withdrawing. Lots of people have signed up to the Kyoto Protocol. Lots of countries have signed up. There's very little evidence that anything has actually happened. We have been saying the right things, but we haven't actually been doing the right things. It's pretty pointless to sign up to an agreement and then not follow through. And so Canada is being honest and is putting up its hand and saying, we cannot meet those obligations, and we are going to stop pretending that we can meet them, because in fact our emissions have gone up like practically everyone else's in the world since the Kyoto Protocol was signed. They have not gone down, despite our best efforts. You know, so we're I think Canada is being honest, and I think that should be applauded. Is it a sign that the IPCC is losing influence? I'm not sure. I would like to think so, but I don't know if there's enough evidence to support that interpretation at the moment.
So, how long has the book been available?
The book, as a Kindle ebook, became available, I think, on October 13th. And a few weeks later, the paperback edition became available. The PDF version also became available on the 13th. So since the end of October, we're looking at, about 2 months. I have to say that I'm quite gratified. I recently had a few reviews in some papers in Switzerland, and another review in a financial newspaper in South Africa. So that's not bad for an unknown person here in Toronto, Canada, writing a book about the IPCC. I'm quite pleased.
Has there been any response from the IPCC itself, or from any of the people addressed in your book?
Well, the IPCC is trying to ignore me. that's a question I get a lot, and so far there has been no official response from the IPCC. They just like to pretend that I don't exist and that my book doesn't exist. A year and a half ago, when I did the counted up all the peer-reviewed material, we called it the citizen audit, and we released our findings and a press release at that point in time. And one media outlet did contact the IPCC and say, do you have any response to this? And their response was, we're aware of the findings, and no, we have no response. So that is about all that the IPCC has been willing to say about the work that I've been doing. On the other hand, the World Wildlife Fund issued a press release in response to my book. That was probably about a month ago now. It came out of head office. And in my book, I say that the World Wildlife Fund has infiltrated the IPCC. And that is not a word that I use lightly or carelessly. What I found was that in the last IPCC report, two-thirds of the 44 chapters had at least one person and as many as nine authors who are formally and publicly affiliated with the WWF. And one-third, so two-thirds have at least some WWF-affiliated personnel, and one-third were actually led by at least one person, sometimes two, who have a WWF affiliation. So I said that the IPCC has been compromised as a scientific organization, that it has been infiltrated by the WWF. WWF took issue with that word, said that it was ludicrous to say that, and their response was that there was some overlap between their personnel and IPCC personnel, but it wasn't infiltration. And I think when you have two-thirds of your chapters that have WWF personnel, that's not some overlap. That is pretty much an invasion. And I think if it was an oil company that had two-thirds people in two-thirds of the IPCC chapters, we'd all see that without any difficulty whatsoever. So the WWF has felt the need to issue a press release in response to my book, but the IPCC has itself not said a word.
Very interesting. Well, Donna Lamframboise, author of The Delinquent Teenager Who Was Mistaken for the World's Top Climate Expert, an IPCC expose, tell people how they can get their hands on a copy of the book.
Well, the book is available on Amazon.com. And also, if you Also, there's another page. There's a page with a Tiny Earl address, which sort of directs you, because you can get this book in Amazon stores, the Kindle edition at least. You can get it in Amazon stores in Germany, in the UK, in Italy. And so there's a page with links. And so the address for that is Tiny Earl, tinyurl.com/. And then the rest of the address is IPCC-book. So tinyurl.com/IPCC-book will bring you to a page on my blog that shows you, here's how you get the PDF, here's how you can get download a free sample. It's got all the information. And I feel very strongly as an author that ebooks should be affordable. There's no paper, there's no printing, there's no ink, there's no shipping. I think ebooks should be very affordable because all of those costs have been removed. So the electronic version of this book is only $4.99. Now, it's more if you buy the paperback. It's normally $20. Amazon has a sale right now. They're selling it for $14.40. But the ebook is very affordable. It's practically the price of a fancy cappuccino. I think it's important that people be able to afford my book because the message is very important.
It certainly is, and a fascinating conversation as well. So, Donna Laframboise, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.